you have 2 minutes to convince me why I shouldn't fire you on the spot. And of course, everybody then turns to look at me.
He's the one that's starting hashtag sack the chairman.
Oh, he might well be. There are many people who are signing up to that.
It's trending.
And then they floated. So when you were saying they were billionaires, they started off being billionaires on paper. They ended up being billionaires in cash.
Up 5% on the week in 7 weeks. Part of me thinks I'm tempted to take some profits there and try and time this market rather than stay involved.
I've got to put my hands up here and say, even I think we've probably had a lot of good news. Maybe it's time to take a wafer thin mint off the table.
My God, Foz, am I hearing things? Houston.
I take back every yellow card that you've had in previous weeks. Your capital is at risk. The value of your shares, ETFs and ETCs can fall as well as rise, which could mean getting back less than you originally put in. This content is for information purposes only and is not investment advice. Past performance is not an indication of future results. Welcome to episode 12 of The Art of Investing, brought to you by IG, the global investment platform. So today we are going to be taking a deep dive into, well, the ETF or trust that has performed the best in our portfolio this week. To give you a clue, you could say that we're digging for some nuggets of extra value in there. Then we're going to go on to one of your questions that you've written in to us by email. And that is the age-old question of what is better for long-term performance? Is it time in the market or timing the market? We'll look at all of that after the Spice Market Review.
Thank you, Rich. This has obviously been a quieter and shorter week than usual, but there's still plenty to talk about, as there always is in markets. Following on from the Federal Reserve's decision to cut interest rates last week, US stock markets have pushed up to new all-time highs.
Hey,
the S&P 500, NASDAQ, the Dow Jones, and even the Russell has pushed up to a 12-month high.
And that's an interesting thing in its own right, because it's been a long time, many years actually, to be able to say that all of them have hit a all-time high, because Russell's been lagging for 2-3 years since 21, and now they're all taking their highs out. So we've got to say there's a lot of optimism around in Trump land.
And that's no bad thing.
Our
portfolio is heavily invested in that part of the market and into the US, which is good. There's also been, because interest rates are effectively coming down in America, that's good for things like gold and precious metals. Because if you own gold, you have to store it and you have to pay an interest charge on doing that. And so that's if you own physical gold. So when the interest rate comes down, your cost of holding it goes down. And so the cost of the metal can go up. And gold has pushed up to a new all-time high. In fact, it pushed very strongly up there this week. And silver has also had a good week, still up at above its 14-year high. A very interesting week for assets and particularly for our portfolio, which we'll touch on later. The other big story going on in the background, well, we mentioned it before, is that there is going to be a new Prime Minister of Japan. And so the electioneering for that starts this week. It only takes about a week or so. It should happen in, we should get the result in 2 weeks. But for the first time ever, one of the favourites is actually a lady. I apologise if I mispronounce her name, but her name is Sane Takaichi. And she is considered a Thatcherist, a Thatcherite.
Oh, really?
Now, that could scare a few people. Those of us who have memories going back to working in markets when Thatcher was in power, that would scare a lot of people out there. But actually, for markets, that was not a bad thing at all. And her main competitor, Shinzo Koizumi.
Brilliant pronunciation. I've got to say, he's multilingual, isn't he?
Well, I did commute to Japan for 2.5 years, but I apologise if I got it wrong, and I'll bow deeply if I have made mistakes there. But he's more of a centrist, and he's much more bullish for stock markets. He looks like he would try and stimulate the economy and get the stock market going. So again, the Nikkei 225, which is the main Japanese stock market, has pushed up to new highs again this week. away from that, we've had some really interesting company news, but this from the biggest companies in the world. NVIDIA has been very busy indeed. They went out and they bought $5 billion worth of Intel. And if you remember a couple of weeks ago, the US government announced they were buying 10% of Intel on the back of Trump's recommendation. And that's helped Intel shares rise nearly 30% since then.
He's a great stock picker, is he?
Donald Trump is a great stock picker.
It's not that he can tell people what to do or anything, is it? He just says, oh, I like that. Oh, do you want to buy some? Oh, maybe they'll buy some as well. And all his friends run around and all buy it. I wish I knew him better.
Yeah, have you not had the early call?
I was going to say, we'll get onto the TikTok deal as well. That maybe a couple of his friends dealt into the deal on that one.
I mean, the reason they're buying a stake in Intel is they want NVIDIA and Intel to collaborate on making new chips for the data centers that we know is proliferating across America and across the world to accommodate AI computing. And that's pretty big news. They also were over here, if you remember, with the delegation when Trump came over last week, and they've announced that they would invest £2 billion in UK startups, a lot of AI, but also things like fintech, Revolut, which you'll hear more about because Revolut are about to float in the US, ironically, but they're also early investors in things like that. And they're going to help the venture capital industry in the UK.
And for all my mickey taking about Trump and all that going on, that's genuinely good news for the UK.
Yeah.
We talked about it with our guest 2 weeks ago about how we've got to get the sort of scale-up industry working in the UK, how we've got to get that investment. And it's really good to see that investment. So I'm giving that a positive. There's not many in my direction to Donald Trump, but I'm giving a positive there.
Finally, it makes the UK's investment a bit small beer because they've invested as well. This is NVIDIA, have announced they're going to invest $100 billion into OpenAI. Now, OpenAI own ChatGPT, which is, as you know, is one of the big AI search engines and is probably the biggest unquoted company in the world now. It was set up by that old bloke, Elon Musk, with no money, although he has got out early. But lots of their friends have made a lot of money in it. And that was a huge investment. And it's basically they want to make it, much bigger and more accessible for the open market. And of course, by doing that, they'll ensure that ChatGPT use NVIDIA chips.
Well, that's the really interesting thing, isn't it? It's that there's $100 billion investment going from NVIDIA into OpenAI for non-controlling shares. But then that $100 billion of investment is to buy NVIDIA chips. And it's over a number of years. Now, what is the reward for investing $100 billion over a number of years? Well, the stock adds $200 billion to its market cap. Do we have a problem here in that kind of promise? You know, and we're seeing promises from Trump every single day. We're seeing Zuckerberg come out and throw out that $600 billion figure and then get caught on microphone saying, I just made it up. I didn't know what you wanted me to say. Are we getting into a position where all the fake news coming out of the White House is feeding through into stock prices, do you think?
No, I don't think so. I mean, look, this is a way for NVIDIA to secure huge market shares for the long term. And this is not a fad. It's going to be around for 5 or 10 years, or if not longer. They are securing a position with the biggest potential AI sort of search engine, ChatGPT, arguably. And why wouldn't you? They've got, $100 billion is a huge amount of money, clearly. But for them right now, it's small change and they're doing it over a long period of time. And that's not a bad price to pay, I would argue, to secure that market share going forward.
I suppose the bigger long-term question is, we've moved from globalization into full-blown protectionism. All this is protectionism. Now, a lot of people would say that the great performance of stock markets over the last 10, 15, 20 years has been the benefits of globalization. And now we're saying the great performance is due to nationalization. So I go back to a comment I made last week, which is everything's a bull market story to those who are bullish. To me, you want to see how the market reacts to these things. And the market is still reacting positively. So I think you have to say it's still in the receptive move to take this stuff. But I wonder when we look back at this in many years' time, I'm not talking about next week or the week after, whether we're going to say, do you know what, was this the start of the change in how the economies are going to be run, which actually means to higher ingrained costs, higher inflation, and more difficult times. Now, Mark, of course, would argue, and I would go with him, that actually, if you have higher inflation, it means earnings go up nicely. And as long as the companies can keep putting their prices up a bit, that's great for profits. Not great for bonds, but bonds are not barking at the moment. They're not saying there's a problem here. So while they're not saying it, the market's going to carry on. So as much as I would like to think this is heralding something more important, at the moment, people are just ignoring it.
So far.
Wow.
So we've gone from the biggest company. Well, let's go to the third biggest company, which is Apple. Apple shares are up 4% yesterday because, if you remember, a couple of weeks ago, they launched their iPhone 17. Bit of a damp squib, let's put it like that. Mm. People are unenthused by it. But actually, the early signs are that the sales are up some 10 or 15% more than the iPhone 16, which was launched last year. They always launch around September time. Those of you who like to upgrade your phones in September, you'll know that. And the important thing is that for Apple, iPhone sales still account for about half of their revenues. So it's still very, very important. And you would think, oh, it's, you know, they make phones, it's not that important anymore. It's still huge.
I question that number a little bit because it came from the CEO of T-Mobile, who was doing a live interview on CNBC, happens to be the outgoing CEO of T-Mobile that was there to announce his resignation and passing on to a colleague. And he was asked, how have sales been this weekend? And he says, oh, it's fantastic. T-Mobile, it's doing incredible things. Our iPhone sales are up 10 to 15% in store in the first weekend compared with last time. And so the market, of course, took it as, well, that's Apple sales up 10 to 15%, put the stock up 4%.
But that's the same point as I'm just saying.
Exactly.
The market wants to hear it. That's great. And I'll say one thing in favour. I haven't had a new phone since 2012. Now you're going to make, don't be too sympathetic towards me. I can see how upset you are about that. I'm just about to order one of these new phones and I've read some reviews on them and they say they've kept it really simple. They haven't done much, but they've changed some colours. And I love the orange one, by the way. That's what I'm going to get, the McLaren orange one. And there's lots of people ordering these things. So I think that's one I can believe that this is going down as a better update than people had thought it was going to be.
No wonder his phone's on to charge, because we've been out for 2 hours before he charged it last.
Well, you touched on McLaren orange there. A bit closer to home, Porsche have had some pretty appalling numbers. And I know Porsche is a company close to your own heart there.
Thank you very much, dear boy.
Porsche and, you know, VW obviously own Porsche as well. Their shares were down 8% yesterday. And that's because they're basically giving up almost on electronic vehicles, EVs, electric vehicles. And they're going back to the good old-fashioned ICE or internal combustion engine cars. And it's going to cost them 2 billion euros to sort of change the production lines, if you like. So yeah, the shares are down 8%.
Now, interestingly, that's their fourth profit warning. Now, what, in your guys' experience, once we get the third or fourth profit warning, is it in the price? Is it time to start looking at them? Or do you just, you know, a change of tact like that, you're scared?
Well, the old rule is they never sell profit warnings in packs of one. They're always coming at least threes. And obviously we've had four out of Porsche, as you say. The time you know it's in the price is when they have a big profit warning and the shares don't go down, they actually go up.
Okay.
And we haven't quite seen that with Porsche yet. Finally, and you'll hear more of this in the next few days, I'm sure, if you listen to the news channels, particularly the business news channels, we're about a week away from the US government running out of money again. So as we come to this time of year, they either have to raise the debt ceiling that the government can borrow money for.
I guess their overdraft limit.
Exactly. Get their overdraft limit raised. Or there has to be legislation sort of passed through Congress to allow them to do that and to maybe find other ways of raising money. But in the meantime, between now and this time next week, you will hear about the threats of potentially the US government shutdown, which means they'll have to lay off workers. People won't be able to go to work and get paid if you're a fireman, policeman, all those other sort of jobs that government employ.
And sometimes there is a little bit of brinksmanship there, isn't it? Everybody's very relaxed until 48 hours beforehand. Then you get a lurch down to 5% in the market and then suddenly something's done.
It's as if it's a game, isn't it? Funny old game, isn't it? You know, this happens every sort of 9 months a year. They agree a number and it's an enormous number that they agree. And then they get to within sort of 2 weeks of it and the in this case, the Democrats will say, "Oh, we're not going to sign off to this." The Republicans say, "Oh, you've got signed off to it." You get closer to it. The market does a 3% fall at some stage, and we go, "Oh my God, let's all sign up because we can't stand this."
This time it's different,
and the bull market continues. We must have seen this 25 times over the last 40 years, or whatever. It's never caused a problem that's lasted more than 24 hours, if that. But it might be something that brings the markets back a little bit, which is good because we're hoping they will come back a little bit because we've got some money to go to work. But if I was to just add a couple of comments, one, bond markets started to get a little bit more interesting last week after the Fed cut. The next day, long bond yields started to move upwards again in the US and in the rest of Europe, only by about 10 basis points. Not a threat yet.
So prices were going down.
So prices were going down. Bond yields were going up. So if you had a bond portfolio, your bond portfolio would have lost money compared to the week before. But nothing major at the moment. This is still the dog that hasn't barked, as I said earlier. But we're expecting it to at some stage, but it's not at the moment.
But sorry, aren't the White House going to reduce interest rates so much over the next 2 years? Why are bond yields going higher?
Well, remember when we were doing our briefing on bonds, the short-dated bonds, 0 to 5 year date maturity bonds, maybe 7 year maturity bonds, are very highly dependent on where interest rates are going to be. So if the Fed's going to cut rates, interest rates that is, then those bonds will do quite well. But the longer dated bonds, the 30-year bonds, remember, are influenced more by the government supply, inflation views, how's the economy going, political risk, all these other factors. And they had started to move up. And so that, you know, you could, if you wanted to, and I think it's far too early to say this, you could argue there was some question in there as to whether they really should have cut rates. And that's starting to emerge. Much too early to say that yet. We'll keep an eye and watch that, but something to keep an eye on. The second thing I thought was interesting is just, it's been noticeable how over the last 6 weeks, European equities particularly have done poorly and the US market has done very well. And that reverses a trend from the start of the year when the US was doing very badly and Europe was doing very well. And there's been a sort of rotational trade. I think people at the start of the year, people certainly like myself, had bought a lot of European equities and got out of the US because we don't like some of the policies that are coming through. We're not sure we like some of Trump's views on this debate around tariffs, that we had moved that way. And then with the interest rates changing in the US and people getting more optimistic about rate moves, the US equity market's done pretty well and the European market's done badly. So it's given back a lot of that relative performance. So now the S&P's done about 14-15% this year and Europe's done about 14-15%, give or take. You know, it's there or thereabouts, having been quite a long way difference. Now, important thing is, over the last couple of days, you're starting to see a bit of rotation in the US equity market, and some of the European markets have started to pick up a little bit. The real question is that just a flash in the pan? Is it just giving back a bit of that performance? Or is that going to be a factor of the next few weeks? Once again, something to watch, but not something that you necessarily... there's nothing we're going to do in our portfolio about that at the moment. It's just something to think in our minds.
It could be a bit of what we call window dressing as we're coming up to the end of the quarter.
Good point.
Where fund managers basically like to make sure their portfolio is in the right shape to be able to go and talk to their investors. And that can mean that quite often, if they've got too much cash, they want to put a bit of cash into the market to put it to work so they don't look like they've been running with too much cash, particularly when markets go up, because that hurts your performance. Or if they've got an overdraft, and a lot of funds are allowed to have a small overdraft, if you're overdrawn, they may need to sell some of their stocks to get some cash in to come back in to have some cash in the balance sheet rather than being overdrawn. And we're coming up to the end of the quarter and you can sometimes get some very funny moves in individual companies, individual stocks and shares, and sometimes it affects the whole market. But we're coming up to the end of the quarter in a week's time and we might see a bit of jiggery pokery on that front in the next week or so.
Now, just hold that thought a minute, Mark, because we are going to be coming to quarterly reviews a little bit later on today. But in the meantime, we're going to pass across to CJ, who's putting a new hat on.
Yeah, I'm trying a Rich's hat on today. It obviously doesn't fit quite so well because he's got hair and I haven't. But today we're doing a deep dive into the natural resources sector, in particular the metals and the mining sector, and how they're reflected in our portfolio. We're lucky today to have Mark and Rich, and they have both got extensive experience in these areas. And before we get on to talk about it in detail, I just wanted Mark to give us a minute on why you got involved in this sector, Mark, why you love it so much, and then I'm going to ask the same question to you, Rich.
Well, I was very fortunate to grow up in Central Africa, and my father worked for a company called Lonro, which many of you will remember as owning Harrods at one time and getting involved with Tiny Roland against Mohammed Al-Fayed and that battle, that corporate battle that went on. Anyway, Lonro had many assets, and one of them was a sugar plantation in a place Malawi where I grew up. But they also had some of the biggest platinum and palladium mines down in South Africa. And so from a very early age, I was very interested in the mining side of Lonro. And because I'd grown up in Africa, mining is prolific across, you know, many of the countries there, and particularly in South Africa, which is obviously very resource rich. So I learned a lot. I wanted to follow these companies. They're great to follow because when they're exploring for things like gold or diamonds or copper or iron ore, they're in the exploration phase, and that can be very exciting. If you make a big discovery, then the share price could go up two or three or four times very quickly if you find a very rich vein of ore or of metal. And that happens in oil as well. If you find a big new oil field, that exploration phase can be really exciting as an investor. And that sort of drew me towards it. Then you get through a really boring phase for these companies where they basically have to, if they found this ore, they have to build a mine. And they have to spend 3 to 5 years building this mine where they make no money at all. In fact, they're just spending. And there's a share price. That's not great for share prices. So as an investor, you sort of like the exploration side, don't like the build-out phase. Yeah. But when they start actually then producing out of that mine once it's built, then you've got maybe 20, 30, 40, 50 years of cash flows that are pretty visible. You can see out a long way. And that's another great time to be investing because they're generating lots of cash. They can do more in more exploration or give it back to shareholders in terms of, you know, dividends or share buybacks or take over other companies. But that, you know, those are big, exciting phases. And that's one of the things that's always attracted me. There's great characters involved in the industry like Tiny Roland. I've got a great story for you, right? And I was in the market when this happened and I was covering the sector, and it's regarding a company called BreeX. This was a Canadian quoted company and had gone from basically a penny share to being a top 300 stock in Canada on the Toronto Stock Exchange, the TSX as it's called. And basically what they'd done is they had this mine in Indonesia for gold. They were mining gold. And they basically took a load of analysts out there and basically showed these analysts down the mine shaft, all these gold, little gold ingots and gold nuggets all the way along this sort of side of this wall. So all the analysts came out hugely enthusiastic about it, upgraded all their forecasts. This company went to $6 billion of market value from being a penny share, being worth virtually nothing. Now, as it turned out, there's this thing in mining called salting. So basically what had happened, a person had taken a shotgun case, filled it with little gold ingots and little gold sort of nuggets, fired it into the wall of the mine. And so they're in the mine, there were all these little gold ingots, and there were basically lots of little bits of gold fired out of a shotgun cartridge. Now, if you've ever been in a gold mine, you don't find gold like that. You just don't find it like that. It comes in a quartz, like you get those magic stones. And in there, you have to crush it. And then you have to put cyanide in it to get rid of all the quartz and gets the gold out. And then you have to process. But you cannot see gold just sitting in a mine. And all these analysts were brought into it. Sure enough, it's a basic blew up. Everyone suddenly realized it didn't happen, mainly because the chief geologist threw himself out of a helicopter and committed suicide. And the share price went to zero. And that was BreeX. So you've got to be pretty careful about some of these mining companies. You've got to know what you're investing in. Do your homework. Be reassured, which is why we're happy to invest in the very biggest ones rather than maybe some of the smaller ones.
Thank you, Mark. Rich, you've got an extensive background in that area as well. Tell us a little bit about what got you involved and what your interests are.
So I was very lucky. The first 2 years of my career were spent trading the retail sector. So Marks and Spencers and Tesco's. Right now, interesting companies, but not the real sex, drugs, rock and roll of volatility. First week in January 2006, I was moved across to the mining desk. And they said, right, these stocks operate a little bit differently. Now, on the 11th of January, so a week into it, Mittal bid for Arcelor, which were two of the stocks in our sector. And that started this cascade of M&A in the sector. And the move ended up making my career because I was the only sell-side trader to have a live copper price. It was one of the things that Credit Suisse did greatly was give us that live. So I would get Morgan Johnson from Marshall Wace phoning up and asking what the live copper price was, or Davis from Clairville was on the phone. You know, what can you do in Xstrata? He wants to know the copper price. So I had a 15-minute sort of ahead of most of the street and was feeding this to all the sales traders and made a name for myself. So I fell in love with the sector very quickly. As Mark says, there's some great characters. Mick Davis of Xstrata.
Oh, I love Mick. Great guy.
He built Xstrata from almost nothing through doing deals along the way. And within, you know, a year and a half of starting in the sector, we had seen BHP try to buy Rios, numerous bidders for the likes of Lonmin, for Vale down in Brazil. And it's not just as you're growing up with a kid, you know, you've got the Tonka trucks and you've, you know, it's pulling these resources out of the ground. It's just really interesting to read about.
You said one thing there for the benefit of everybody. You said sell side. When we say sell side, what do we mean?
So, yeah, so we've got what Mark was involved in for the majority of his career on the buy side.
Which is managing the money.
So essentially you're buying research and ideas from the sell side, and the sell side are the investment banks and the brokers. Now, another thing is IPOs. I had the good fortune to be the man who was involved in opening Glencore. So it was the biggest ever IPO on London Stock Exchange in 2011 at its time. Yeah, we IPO'd Glencore, real old school style. You know, you couldn't have it on the computer. You needed to know your buyers and your sellers. And I had, you know, just scribbling down orders. And we were making it in $100 million on the touch, even in the mids.
That touch is the difference between the buy and the sell price, or the buy and the sell price.
You can tell how excited I am. I'm going back into trader lingo without explaining it.
Yeah, I mean, Glencore is amazing. I one of my best days ever as an investor was I had the pleasure to go over to Zug in Switzerland and sit in front of these heads of businesses within Glencore. I've never to this day had more billionaires rolled out in front of me in the space of an afternoon than I did that afternoon. I probably saw five billionaires, one after the other, who was in charge of copper or in charge of iron or in charge of coal. And these guys just one after the other. And the flotation gave them that money. And what did they do with it? They put it all in Switzerland, paid no tax on it. Well, lovely.
Yeah. Were you involved in the, did you buy some in the allocation?
Only small. Right. Well, we did buy some, but it was a bad price. You just knew it was a bad price because, okay, you know, these guys were just cashing in literally billions of dollars.
And funnily enough, commodity prices had gone higher into the IPO.
So in fairness, you know, and I'm not an expert in this area, but I seem to remember bits of this. What you're actually saying is a very well executed exit plan. Because Glencore, for those who don't know Glencore, and I'm now on dodgy ground because I'm going to talk to you guys, I just mentioned it, they were a trading house in lots of different commodities. So they had a guy head of oil, they had a guy head of mining, and they all had stock in the company. They waited for the stock to get right up at the very top, and then they floated. So when you were saying they were billionaires, they started off being billionaires on paper. They ended up being billionaires actually in cash.
While the rest of the street nursed their losses as the stock IPO'd, it came at £5.30. It opened at 8 a.m. at £5.49 and didn't see that level for 12 years.
There we go. You see, timing is everything. I think we might be thinking about that a bit later as well. Okay, so let's go to the portfolio. That was a lovely intro. Thanks, guys. Now, we've got a number of holdings within our portfolio. We've got our position in gold, we've got a position in copper, but we've also got the BlackRock World Mining Trust. And I'm aware that we've not really given a lot of background on that over the past few weeks. So, Rich, why don't you take us through what's in that? And you and Mark, you can discuss, you know, some of the factors that made us think about that.
That's right. So there's numerous ways that we could have gotten exposure to mining metals resources. We've chosen to buy a little bit of copper. We've chosen to buy a little bit of gold. But this gave us the exposure to the names in a way that we trust in the BlackRock Mining Trust. And it's built up of holdings in each of the large cap miners. And so if I just go through the list of where the exposure is, it's 8% each of Rio's and BHP. So two of the biggest mining companies in the world. And then Glencore that we've mentioned, 7% is Glencore, 6.5% is Anglo American, and then Freeport McMoRan. So each of these has slightly different portfolios of commodities. And if I really wanted copper, I might go to Freeport or an Antofagasta, which are copper-specific mining stocks. But then the diversifieds, as we call it, that's more like Rio's and BHP.
When you say diversified, you mean because they're not just single metals they're digging out the ground. It's a well-diversified portfolio, so maybe one or two of the things might be doing well, maybe one or two aren't, but they're diversified, a bit like a good portfolio.
Exactly like a good portfolio. So you've got, you know, iron ore, copper, coal, some have got oil, and they trade it like a portfolio, right? Sometimes they make big mistakes. Rio's make a terrible acquisition that got into aluminium, and it left them, you know, writing down the value of these assets for years. Mining's great in that way, is that you're building a portfolio of exposure to a commodity that you want exposure to at that time. Then we go further down the list and we find Cameco. Now, Cameco's now in uranium, right? So then we're adding a bit of exposure. We've not just got gold and copper and iron ore, but we've also got uranium in there.
And by the way, uranium is a big play at the moment. It's done very well because a lot of companies in the data center world, we go back to data centers and AI, there's a huge amount of power required to run all these computers and the supercomputers. And interestingly, I think it's Microsoft have actually reopened Three Mile Island, which is an old nuclear power plant in America, so that they could use the power from that to power their data centers going forward. Yeah. And they've signed it for a 20-year deal. So uranium, there's lots of these small reactors now that are being used to power these plants. So uranium demand is going up and up and up.
Isn't it funny how things come round full circle? If you go back to Fukushima, then uranium was such a dirty word. But now that AI needs so much energy and questions over its sustainability, then suddenly we're happy with these mini reactors.
And it's a clean energy, right? It is a clean, clean power source. Whereas coal, which is when Fukushima happened in Japan, there was the earthquake that led to the tsunami that hit the nuclear power plant there in Fukushima. They had to close that down. China were building 450 new nuclear power stations at that time. They stopped pretty much overnight. Germany closed all of their nuclear power stations down. Japan did. And all this demand for uranium just suddenly disappeared. And then there was a glut of uranium. The price collapsed, as did many share prices that were associated with it. And Chris and I know but one called Geiger Counter that did very well all the way up. It's now doing very well again.
Doing very well again, yeah.
Exactly. So you've got to be conscious of the end markets for these things. And uranium is unique in that sense. It's one of the reasons we probably wouldn't have it in this portfolio, because there are those associated risks, which you wouldn't get in copper, for example.
If my understanding is correct, it's very cyclical, the metals industry. We've got a nice broad exposure to a big range of these metals. Why are we so confident at the moment that that's a good exposure to have? Because, of course, we might get exposure and it not be a good time to do it. Why are we thinking, I mean, clearly it has been a good time because the way these prices move, but give our listeners some sort of clue as to what's the driver behind some of these things.
Let me run you through the exposure to commodities. We've done it to actual stocks.
Yeah.
So we've got 32% exposure to gold and precious metals. Right. So that includes silver and platinum and palladium as well. Then we've got 25% of copper. And we know from following the single stock stories that copper is in such high demand because it's actually quite hard to find production growth going forward.
So hold on. Uranium is for nuclear reactors. Copper. Why is copper so? Let's go that for that one.
Well, it's used in computers. It's used in sort of power transmission. The best conductor for electricity is copper. And when copper became so expensive a few years ago, I remember the Chinese started making an alloy. They mixed aluminium and copper because copper was so expensive. And there was a massive glut of aluminium, which we talked about. Rio Tinto had bought all this aluminium. There was too much aluminium in the world. The price had gone down. And then the Chinese said, oh, we're going to mix copper and aluminium. That's not as good a transmitter as, of electricity as copper, pure copper is, but it's a hell of a lot cheaper if you mix it in with aluminium. And so they did, as they were building out railways and rebuilding, sort of building out their infrastructure from the big cities in China. But right now, copper, it goes into these data centers, right? It's, again, huge demand.
I think we've got an ETF link to that as well. But that's last week's podcast.
Yeah.
And then electric vehicles also take a great deal of copper. So it's positioned very well in all the thematic ideas that have come through.
Okay, so I've got copper, uranium. What I've got some gold. We all know that gold's been doing fantastically. What else?
Then we've got 11% iron ore. Now, iron ore is, of course, what goes in to making steel. So you take a heap of iron ore, you take a heap of coal, and then you get it very hot, and you get steel coming out the other end. So 11% exposure to iron ore. China are huge buyers of iron ore, and which has done very great things for the Australian economy over the years, hasn't it?
As I think you have to remember, right, that China are very influential when it comes to commodities, full stop. They still buy approximately 50%, half of the world's commodities. And in iron ore particularly, they're still massive. They still buy about, I think it's about 75% of all the iron ore that's produced in the world. They buy about 50% of all the copper that's produced in the world. So they are, we've got, if the Chinese economy is going badly, it's not great for the end markets for some of these. Now, there is AI and things like that offsetting to things like copper. But China right now are trying to turn their economy, which has been in decline for a few years, back into a growth mode. And that means they've got to spend money on building infrastructure, railways, you know, plants, electric sort of, you know, vehicles, and big manufacturing areas, which chew up huge amounts of iron ore and copper, etc. So China's beginning to stimulate. That should be good for the end demand of these metals. But interestingly, there's no new supply coming on. We can see, you know, it's very easy to see. As we said earlier on, if you wanted to build a new copper mine today, if you find the discovery, that might take you 3 or 4 years to get it approved. Then you have to start building the plant. It takes you another 5 years before you can even start selling the copper. Now, that gives you a huge amount of visibility as an investor that there's no more copper coming on in new areas for that period of time. That's an investable time horizon. Most equities look 6 to 9 months forward, let alone 5 years. So we know the demand is there because China are trying to stimulate. Again, the world's picking up and growth is picking up again. Data centers are using all this sort of stuff. But there's no new supply. Remember what we said, supply and demand are the biggest driver of share prices and commodity prices, even more so in commodities, because supply and demand is where it is most basic. In shares, you have dividends, you have other issues, you know, are they going to be taken over? You have all these issues. In commodity, it's simply supply and demand. So if you know supply is tight, demand is going up, the price should go up.
This is why we both love it so much, because it's so basic.
Yes.
It is just demand and supply. And that has changed because it's a bit of a hangover from COVID. Because, of course, you said and rightly stated that this sector is very cyclical, right? So if the economy goes into a downturn, these companies have to pull all their CapEx and they have to save their balance sheets. So during 2020, 2021, you weren't getting any investment into the long-term mines and production. So now, in 2025, you're suddenly left over, well, where do I get my production growth for 27, 28? I've got to go and buy it. And the only way to buy it is look for companies like Anglo American that have got real high-quality copper mines, and you go and buy them. And that's what BHP tried to do to Anglo's last year. They managed to fend them off. BHP walked away. And now Anglo's and Teck Cominco, which was bid for by Glencore and is 3.5% of our fund, they've now married and are merging in the next year to give themselves great cost savings of copper production in Chile. So, as I say, it's a hotbed of M&A, and it's because they're all chasing the same commodity. And that gives us great belief in this copper exposure that we've got outside of the mining trust as well. Grow your portfolio with IG. Invest £50 with IG and get a free share bundle worth between £40 and £200. Make your first investment into an ISA, GIA or SIPP account by the 30th of September and benefit from commission-free investing as well as 4% variable interest on cash. Other fees may apply. Terms and conditions found in the show notes or on ig.com/UK. Start your investing journey with IG today.
Guys, that's really exciting. And I'm now an avid believer in this stuff. But before I change my whole portfolio around for it, you mentioned earlier, Mark, about Porsche having some terrible results because they were pulling out of electric cars. Does that move by them, I mean, clearly not on their own, but clearly that marked some sort of move away from electric cars being the next big thing, would that put some pressure on the valuations you're talking about for things like copper and other things?
Right now, we're at this real instance of sort of two big sort of demand pools. One has been electric vehicles, but it's actually, compared to the overall size of the market, I think off the top of my head, it's about 5% of copper was basically being drawn into electric vehicles. Now, electric vehicle sales are down heavily, but they've not completely disappeared. But they're down, you know, and in Europe, they're down about 40%, which is why Porsche are trying to pull back. They're not going to stop doing electric cars. They're just pulling back from developing the new ones and concentrating on the older ones. But at the same time, we've talked about it time and time again, data centers and the whole proliferation of supercomputing really is offsetting that. And I have to say that I think without actually that sort of pullback in electric vehicles usage, then the copper price would be substantially higher than it is today.
I would also say, for example, if you were going to ask me, right, what would change your mind on this? It is China. As Mark alluded to, it's always been China since 2005. This sector depends on the Chinese economy and its industrial production and the real estate as well. Now, it hasn't had that tailwind for the last few years, right? China never really came out of COVID with a great growth program. So it is going to be dependent on the stimulus. We think we're at the start of a stimulus period, right? So that should be a tailwind that the sector hasn't had in previous years. But if something went wrong in China, it would change my mind and we'd have to be pretty quick about amending the exposure.
China had a big problem with a property bubble. And for the last 5 years, they've been deflating it. In other words, they've been trying to get property house prices down because people were over borrowing against that. And then people were going bankrupt and it was causing all sorts of issues in the system. They've been trying to sort that now for 5 years. We are coming to the end of that. And there are signs that the property market is beginning to turn and beginning to look a bit more stable. That would be good for starting to build new property because there's been virtually no new builds out in China. Because they've been deliberately trying to push the property market down. If that's turning, demand should pick up.
Okay, so I'm taking it from that we're happy with what we've got. We think there's a very bullish story around some of those metals, some of the mining companies. If something happened in China, we'd be watching those things very carefully. But until that happens, we're happy with the exposure we've got.
Yeah,
is that what we're saying? I've really enjoyed putting on Rich's hat. It's been great. I haven't had to do too much. Well, now I'm going to hand it back to Rich. Over to you.
Good stuff. Right, so we're going to have a look at the portfolio. However, I fancy this could be a little bit more brief than usual because next week we've got something to look forward to. And that's because not only is it the change of the month, it is the change of the quarter. As Mark alluded to, quarter end leads us into time to do a bit more of a deep review, as you gents will have been accustomed to during your portfolio management days. What happens, CG, at the end of every quarter?
Rich, I was enjoying this podcast until you reminded me about some of those meetings that I used to have to attend at the quarter end because they were a fairly emotional experience. When I was at Mercury, we had over 20 billion of money that we were looking after for more than 150 clients. We'd probably have 300 meetings each year. Each of those meetings would be reporting on performance. And you'd be going through a pack to say, this is what we did this quarter, this what worked, this what didn't work, and this is what, and this is how the overall result is. Now, the problem with being the boss is that you're never invited to go along to these meetings when they're good, because anybody can do them. The only time you have to go is when the meetings are bad. And, you know, clearly, I'm a very successful fund manager, as you all know, but there are times when it's been terrible and I've had to go along and see clients. And, you know, there are ways this works well and there are ways it doesn't work well. So I'm going to give you an example of each one. There was one client that I went to see after a very poor quarter. We just started managing the money. So this is the sort of first review meeting. I've got to really go anyway. And the performance is poor and it's a lot worse than it should be. We've read it completely wrong. We'd underperformed. I went in there thinking I'm getting a real rollicking from these people. They're going to really be going for it. Gave them reasons for it. No anger, no nothing. It was tense, but there was no issues at all. Nice, good questions, sensible, whatever. Next quarter, I go along and we've had a really good time. And I think I better go back and talk to these guys. So I go back in to talk to them, tell them how well we've done. Walk out, the chairman follows me out. He says, if you ever perform as badly as you did in that first quarter, I'm going to fire you. But I felt the right thing to do was to not put you under pressure, to allow you to think more about how you were going to do in the next quarter. So that's how you should handle it when you've done badly.
He's the one that's starting hashtag sack the chairman.
Oh, he might well be. But, you know, and there are many people who are signing up to that.
It's trending.
The second example is one that went completely the other way. I went to see another client once again after a period of bad performances. This is coming a bit of a trend, unfortunately. I went with the guy who actually managed the fund and a sales guy. So I thought, well, I'm just really in tow to say a good few, the odd word now and again, because these guys have got the relationship. We walked in, the chairman stood up and he said, your performance is terrible. You have 2 minutes to convince me why I shouldn't fire you on the spot. And of course, everybody then turns to look at me. So I've suddenly got to now appear center stage telling them why we've been so stupid and got things wrong, but why we're right for the long term and all this sort of stuff. And in the end, it had a happy ending. So that was fine. The point of what I'm trying to bring out here is people blame the city for short-termism. But the fact is you're going every quarter to talk to clients and it's a lot of pressure. I'm not expecting sympathy. I was paid very well to do it. But at the end of the day, it's a lot of pressure on people. That makes them take those profits early and not run things for too long because they want to make sure that they've got those things in the right spot. Next week, we're going to have our quarterly performance meeting where we'll run through each of our positions, how they've done. We'll assign an owner to each one. Somebody's got to be responsible. I mean, what normally happens is if something doesn't work, it's the chairman's fault. If something does work, it's somebody else's. And we're not going to have that next week.
I fancy that might not be the case. Yeah, well,
next week, of course, everything works going to be my idea. But we're going to put names to each position, get people to talk about why we've still got them, do we believe in them still or not, and go through a proper review. But that's for next week.
Well, this week, I think you gents are going to be surprised, somewhat pleasantly, about the benchmark that we have crossed. We are now up 5.04%. in the 7 weeks that we've been running this portfolio. So well done both.
Thank you.
Can we stop now?
Well, if we look at it, the World Mining Trust is our best performer of the week that we've just done a deep dive on. VanEck Crypto Blockchain Innovators ETF has performed yet again, is now up 30% on the year. Then we've got NASDAQ, good performer this week. Gold up 2.5%. The SAFE trade is moving at 2.5% a week. We look down at the bottom, even the worst performer is down only 28 basis points. So a really strong week and leads us into the question perfectly. The question of the week is, what is better in the long term for portfolio management? Is it timing the market or is it time in the market? Because up 5% on the week in 7 weeks, part of me thinks, oh, I'm tempted to take some profits there and try and time this market rather than stay involved. Mark, what do you think?
Well, I think, you know, we are professional investors. And therefore,
sorry, you couldn't help. Give a straight voice, a straight face.
I am a professional investor. And as a result, we are expected to be able to see the nuances in the market moves and to appreciate sometimes when things get a bit overstretched on the upside or oversold on the downside when people get too pessimistic. And we should always be pragmatic about these things and be prepared perhaps to take advantage of that. Now, as professional investors, that is our day job. We're doing that day in, day out, hour by hour, and watching markets all the time. Most people don't have that luxury. And therefore, they have to maybe look at their portfolio once a day or once a week or once a month or whenever they get time to do it, or at the weekend. Those people don't want to be trying to pick the peaks and the troughs week by week or day by day in the market. Yeah. And therefore, they're probably better off just staying in the market, shutting their eyes when it goes a little bit wrong, enjoying it when it goes well, but being there, being time in the market, if you like.
If you're choosing to listen to a podcast about investing, we're probably hoping to get some education out there to move you from that position more towards one where you might spot things that you wouldn't have necessarily spot before. Is that right, Chris?
I think the way we're trying to run the portfolio is with a mind to time in the market, but also timing the market. So we're not trying to actively trade all the time here, because we know most of the people listening to this podcast have a day job. They're doing other things. They can't automatically do what we're thinking. So we don't want to be pushing people into being too active. We would regard ourselves as professional investors, much as I laughed.
I didn't laugh this time.
No, you didn't laugh. That was really kind of you, Mark. But at the end of the day, we would regard ourselves as professional investors. And the professional investor is about timing. I mean, if it isn't about timing, I don't know what it is. So, if you go see any wealth manager, they will tell you it's time in the market, not time in the market. They're not trying to do that active management. We are trying to do it, but we're trying to do it with sort of one hand tied behind our back, because we recognize the people who are listening to this won't be able to trade as actively as we would normally trade. So I would follow Mark's advice completely. If you're interested in these financial assets is part of what you're doing, but it's not a main part of what you're doing, then you want to be sitting in the market for as long as possible. What we're trying to do is just help those people with when things get a bit silly, maybe take a little bit out and move somewhere else. One of the key things, though, you've got to remember is we have set ourselves a performance of absolute return target of 10%. So therefore, we're going to be thinking about things not in terms of how's my equities done versus some other market? How are those sorts of conversations, which a professional investor will be thinking about all the time. We've got to look at it against how we're doing relative to that target. So I think you can be a little bit more active on that. If you've achieved your 10, if you're up at 12, you're up at 15, you may say, I want to have a rest for the moment. I want to take it easy. So we're trying to address that. We're trying to give people a little bit of confidence. They could try a bit of timing the market. But we're not trying to get in any way, shape, or form the impression that it's an actively traded a portfolio. This is more about, you can sort of fire and forget to a degree. There will be some activity.
The way I like to explain it to my students that I try and teach investing to, I try to get them to think about it as often as they'll go to the dentist for a checkup, right? Whether that's every 3 months or 6 months. That's how often they should be looking at their portfolio, at their savings, their SIP, ISA, their pension, in the minimum. Because if you're taking a portfolio and earning 20% a year, and you just think that you can sit back and never look at it, I think that's a bit lazy. Because if you're going to work every day, you build up this portfolio to a decent size and you're making 20% of it, that's a hell of a lot of money. That's a big return by the time you get to CJ's age. You know, to not think that you need to do any work for these returns and they just come to you. No, I think you should be doing a little bit of work. And not necessarily, I'm not saying trade it by any means. I'm just saying learn the basics. And that's what we're trying to do here. Learn a little bit about valuation and see when we're extended and when we might be oversold.
To me, I think you should think about a proper quarterly portfolio review, which is what we are talking about doing. As we've talked before, look at the weekly by all means, get excited about it, but really look at it quarterly. And when you get that information, you've given it quite a bit of time over that quarter to run, and look at things at that point. Lots of people will be able to get their pension valuations from their pension provider. You can go in at the end of the quarter, look at what it looks like. Think about some of the things that we've been talking about. Maybe ask your wealth manager why he's got the positions he's got. But I honestly think that anything more regular than quarterly is getting a little bit too regular, because we want to let these things work and get through.
Okay, so it's coming up towards the end of the quarter. Mark stated, you know, there's a can be a little bit of jiggery pokery goes on. It has been known in the end of the quarter. I put to you that we've only really bought things. We've only added to our risk so far. And it's been the right call. It's been a fantastic call, Spice. But we're up 5%. Is there any temptation to take a little bit off the table here? Because you told me it's new highs on the S&P, it's new highs on the NASDAQ, it's new high on the Nikkei, it's new highs in gold.
I'm nothing if not a pragmatist. And I learned that from working with Chris for many years. And what I will say is that in the last 2 weeks, we've had some exceptionally good news for some of the biggest companies in the world. And I'm talking about Oracle is a top 10 holding in the world in the US. NVIDIA, we talked about at length earlier today. Apple, with their new iPhone going well. In the last couple of days, that's pushed NASDAQ up quite nicely, up to new highs, comfortably through the new highs. And we've also had the start of the interest rate cuts in America. I've got to put my hands up here and say, even I think we've probably had a lot of good news, and now might be prudent to take...
My God, Foz, am I hearing things right?
A wafer thin...
Houston.
I take back every yellow card that you've had in previous weeks.
To quote Monty Python and Mr. Creosote, maybe it's time to take a wafer thin mint off the table. And I would actually trim our NASDAQ position. I'd cut it in half, take 5% out. Now, I personally would want to put that into cash, but not into the short gilt. Remember, short gilts we used as a proxy for cash. But we're so close to a budget in the UK, that part, those short-dated UK gilts may come under a bit of pressure as we approach the budget. I therefore would personally like to say, take 5% out of NASDAQ, move it into cash, real cash, which through IG, I think we can earn 4% annually on that. And then keep it there in store and ready for if there are any pullbacks or any disappointments, or if this exuberance that we've seen a bit of in the short term gives us an opportunity to buy into any dips. And I'm a big fan of buy the dip. There's a very rude way of saying that. I won't be drawn into that. But buy the dips, then I'd be happy to do that.
Can you just pinch me? I'm wondering if
punch,
I'm...
I'd rather punch you, that's all.
We didn't have to do it 2 weeks ago. We made a bit of money by hanging on for 2 weeks.
No. Okay. And let's take that cash and run before he changes his mind. So we're selling half of our NASDAQ position. That's 5% of the portfolio. That's moving into cash.
Sorry, Chairman. Have we changed hats? Well, we did change hats earlier, in fact.
If you could reach that.
Yeah, I can. Yeah.
So
I'm going to go a little bit further. I don't have any great problem there. Mark's had a great call on the US markets. They've done very well. So why not, you know, take half out there? I'm also quite tempted because I feel when we look at what we're trying to do, we're trying to do 10%. We've done 5%. So we're halfway to our target. Very quickly, and there's a lot of things hitting new highs. I'm looking at my holdings up there and say, what have I got 10% of that's done pretty well? And I look up there and I see gold as having done very well indeed. Now, I'm not suggesting we should sell gold completely. All of us look in different ways. I look at how gold is moving relative to all its moving averages. And when I look at how it's moving in association with its daily, weekly, and monthly moving averages, it's looking more expensive than I have ever seen it.
And so this is technical analysis.
It's trying to get the chart to speak to me. It doesn't often speak to me, but when it does, it's normally quite good. I'm suggesting at the moment it is speaking to me that the wise man takes a little bit off the table, keeps the rest running, go back to what the art of execution, the connoisseur, keeps a bit running, but takes a little bit off the table. So given we've done so well, I actually think we might suggest we sell 5% of NASDAQ, 5% of gold. Gold's done really well in a period when equities have done really well. It's meant to be a different sort of asset. So when I go and look at all these things, I think let's just take a little bit off.
Yeah. And you mentioned that yields had been going
and
back
yields
up.
Have gone up a little bit at the long end as well. So, you know, I'm just got a feeling that we should just say, well done, let's move a little bit aside. We're still very invested in markets. We will still be exposed to the upside or any downside, but it just gives us a little bit of ammunition if the market does drift back a little bit. I'm in agreement, Mark. I would put both of those in a cash instrument that yields 4%. We've always said on this podcast, the biggest risk you can have is holding cash. So we mustn't think of this as a long-term investment. This is an investment to just take a breather, just see how the next few weeks transpire, and then look to find an opportunity to get it back in there. The real chairman's suggestion is we sell half our NASDAQ and half our gold into cash.
And can I say one of the reasons I don't advocate selling out of all of these positions is that it's very difficult mentally, if you've sold out of position, to keep following it. And then even if it comes down, to buy back into it. It's quite hard mental discipline to do that. So if you retain a bit of a holding in there, even though at a much smaller size, you're still following it, you're still invested in it, and therefore you are looking for opportunities, if you like, to take your position back up again. And for me personally, that's a very good way of staying and keeping with a position over the long term.
Excellent. Right. That is the portfolio review. Are we at peak positive news flow? And that has led us to take half the position off the NASDAQ and half the position off gold after a stellar performance since we bought it up 9%.
We've got some great numbers here. In our wildest dreams, I think we wouldn't have thought we'd have done as well as this. I think it's just prudent to take a little bit of money off the table. So that's what we're going to do.
Okay, now, so that answers the question, hopefully, is it better to time the market or is it all about time in the market? Well, a little bit of both. If you can do both of the things, but top slice here and there, then you're well on your way to your target for the year. So thank you very much, Claire from Hitchin, for that question on timing the market versus time in the market. If any of our other viewers or listeners have a question for us, please email in to
the art of investing at ig.com.
It gets better by the week. Join us next week for the great portfolio interrogation. And let's hear how these guys conduct themselves after the end of a quarter. Thanks for joining us.